Okay, the next argued case is number 21, 1926, Azurity Pharmaceuticals Incorporated against BioPharma Inc. Mr. Torsen.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Richard Torsen with Nick Halkowski here for Azurity BioPharma. This is an ANDA case. It involves...
Speak up a little bit, please.
I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor. This is an ANDA case. Azurity sued BioPharma because it had an abbreviated new drug application directed toward a liquid oral formulation for enalapril. Azurity has a patent, Epined, which is a branded product for this. We would like to start with the buffer, particularly the court's related construction of buffer, because that's really fundamentally why we're here today. A court must avoid a surprising and prejudicial construction of a term late in the proceeding. Neither party provided a construction for buffer. Both sides agreed that the plain and ordinary meaning applied. Yet, the court surprised Azurity when it narrowed the meaning of buffer when it was doing its analysis.
That's in connection with the issue of whether or not there's actual infringement?
The only issue in this case is doctrine of equivalence.
I didn't see that this issue popped up in connection with the analysis of the prosecution history estoppel issues.
Well, you can't apply a term more narrowly than you've construed it. So if you're applying a term narrowly, and in this case, saying there's no buffer whatsoever.
Right. I just couldn't. The way I saw this issue coming up in the briefing wasn't with respect to the estoppel issues, but with respect to the question of whether there was actual infringement of the product, and I wasn't understanding how it's pertinent to the main issues. And you've got several hurdles you have to overcome here.
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor, and in fact, that's why at the end of our opening brief, we actually point to the Sabella case that this court decided, I believe, last fall. The point here is even if you decide the case on a different issue, we're still faced with the issue that our friends are saying there's an estoppel in other fora.
Can I ask you a different question? Just what is the legal issue that your argument about the interpretation of buffer relates to so that we can make sure it's not seeking an advisory opinion? Because that's what I hear Judge Clevenger asking you, but I still don't know what your answer is to that question.
Okay, it's not an advisory decision because we actually have active controversies. In fact, if you look at page 2 of the red brief, they tell you that there's a pending case, or not no longer pending case, a case that's been dismissed subject to what the court decides on this issue. So that's the problem. We were stuck with a belated construction. We haven't had a chance to address it, and yet we're...
But what is the issue that it relates to on appeal in this case? Is it functionally result? What is it?
Right. It's whether the buffer is met by the function way result.
Okay, that's okay. what I thought it was. That's all I was looking for.
Okay. I'm sorry. So in that sense, why don't we go ahead and jump to the analysis. First of all, the court imposed several additional requirements on what a buffer must be. And they did this solely relying on extrinsic evidence. There's nothing in the claims or in the specification that requires this. Among them, it required that the buffer have a specific pKa. And it also imposed two process limitations on a buffer. The specific pKa is that it has to be within one unit, pH unit of the formulation. But there's nothing in the intrinsic evidence that requires it. And in fact, we know that that's inconsistent with the specification because, among other things, the specification identifies a phosphate buffer that's more than one unit away from the formulation.
Do you mind telling me the page that you're relying on specifically in the board's opinion for where you think it construed the claims? Because I kind of viewed that discussion as being a fact finding as opposed to a claim construction. And just so you see where I'm at and thinking that it's a fact finding, I want you to know up front that's what I'm thinking so you can respond to that observation.
Okay, I'll point you to the court's decision at Joint Appendix 69.
Where
it says, neither of these are within one pH of the claim formulation pH. Okay? That only makes sense if the judge was reading that as a requirement of the pH. So there is an implicit construction going on there because there's nothing in the term pH that by itself requires that. As I pointed out, that's actually inconsistent with at least one of the buffers in the intrinsic evidence. So that can't be right. That cannot be the plain and ordinary meaning of the term, and it can't be the meaning
of the term. I'm still missing why you're spending all this time in your oral argument on an issue that we may never even reach. Because if we agree that there's amendment-based estoppel or argument-based estoppel, we don't reach these issues. Right?
Well, again, that puts us exactly.
They don't
where...
reach. I mean, if Judge Stark for the court was correct that amendment-based estoppel applies here, or if not that argument-based estoppel, then your doctrine of equivalence claim fails, and we never reach the question of whether there was actual infringement.
Right. That's why Sabella is so informative.
So you have two grounds, and then you've got the preservative limitation that you devote about two pages of your brief to. And if we agree with the district court on that one, then all this other argument is irrelevant.
I'm happy to jump to that part if Your Honors wish, but I just to directly answer the question you posed, once again, my friend is raising this as an estoppel in other courts. If the claim construction exists and is right, then they would be right. If it doesn't exist or it's not right, then there can't be an estoppel. So just basic fairness requires that something happen to that, even if you decide the case on a different basis. And in fact,
your brief didn't attempt to undermine the estoppel arguments, amendment-based or argument-based on this claim construction ground. I'm having that trouble with the connection, which we talked about.
Well,
you want to spend a minute or two on the preservative limitation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I do want the court to take into consideration Sabella, where very, very similar circumstances exist, except there they'd actually waive the infringement argument.
Right, but I mean, the whole question about buffer and whether the claim construction was wrong is irrelevant if we agree with the district court on the preservative limitation.
Except that you run into the equitable problem. And it's a live equitable
problem.
No,
but I mean, if the preservative limitation is not met by equivalence, there can't be any infringement.
Okay, well, let's go to the preservative problem. So the court addressed that issue as a disclosure dedication doctrine.
And your main argument was that the district court didn't understand the law, didn't understand the degree of specificity was required because they didn't cite the right case.
No, that would oversimplify our position. Our position is actually that the case law requires that the intrinsic evidence, the specification itself, must disclose, identify
the
unclaimed
element. Your argument was one of applying the wrong standard.
Right. Well,
and then you come back and say the correct standard, you know, can be found in PSC computer.
I think they're the ones who are arguing.
Judge Stark cited Pfizer, and Pfizer relies on PSC computer. Indeed, PSC computer has exactly the language that you're saying is correct, and Judge Stark incorporated that in his legal analysis.
Now, I think you're relying on my friend's brief. Our position is SanDisk actually cites the right standard, and SanDisk says you can't have a generic disclosure, which is all we have here, right? We say parabens. And we list some examples of parabens, none of which are the preservative that they are claiming, or I'm sorry, using.
Why isn't example 3C, some of the examples like in table C1 in appendix page 214, columns 33 and 34 of the patent, why aren't those specific enough? You say that there has to be specificity, and I think I understand your argument to be that there is no disclosure of the mixture, but I see the mixture. For example, in table C1, sodium methylparaben, sodium propylparaben. Why isn't that sufficient?
Well, sodium benzoate, I mean, there.
Yeah, there's a blank spot in there for your sodium benzoate. If you look for component C1 and C2, you'll see for C1 and C2 formulations, there is a blank for the sodium benzoate. There is no sodium benzoate in C1 and C2. Do you see?
Yes,
it's line 65 of columns 33.
The specification identifies the methylparaben and propylparaben as species. It doesn't identify them as a mixture except
for in this example I've pointed out.
So the example does show these being used, but it doesn't specifically disclose using them as a mixture. It's not clear how they've been used or added.
Why? I mean, you have to show that a finding to the contrary, which is the finding the district court made, is clearly erroneous.
Okay, so once again then, would get us back
actually,
to...
Actually, it's a legal issue.
You're right. Mm-hmm. You're right. Even if the court wants to decide the case on the basis of the dedication...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Even if the court wants to decide the case on this issue, once again we get to the problem, what do you do with the lingering claim construction? And once again, this is what Sabella directly
addressed. So you're really here because you want that claim construction corrected.
Again, look at the facts in Sabella. In Sabella, the appellant had actually conceded the infringement argument, conceded it, which the court found created a standing problem. But the problem it also faced, the reason it took the appeal at all, is because it was being confronted with this estoppel argument. And the problem is, if we never have a chance to address it, it's not fair to do that. So if this court is going to affirm on an alternative basis, which is the case, I'm sorry, recite Jennings versus Stevens is one of the cases we cite for this.
Can you speak up a little?
I'm sorry, I've got
to It's okay, we just need to speak up a little bit. With plexiglass we have in here, it makes
it
even harder
to hear.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, and I'm in an echo chamber, so it sounds loud to me. Okay, we cite, among other cases, Jennings versus Stevens for the idea that when the court affirms on an alternate basis, that changes what the estoppels are. So if this court says we're deciding only on the disclosure dedication doctrine, that would solve our problem for us as well. Again, fundamentally, our concern in this case is that the buffer construction is wrong as a matter of fact, wrong as a matter of law, and yet this is the only forum we've been allowed to address that in. And I'm way into my rebuttal, so I'm going to...
Well, thank you. I appreciate your clarification of the significance of the claim construction issue. It really lies outside of this case.
Thank you. Mr. Elliott.
May it please the court. May I remove my mask? May it please the court. Andy Lowell on behalf of defendant appellee Bion Pharma, Inc. Bion Pharma is a small generic drug company. We don't serially file ANDAs seeking approval to market generic versions of patented brand name drugs. We're not an Apotex. We're not a Teva. We're not a Mylan. We did everything we could to avoid infringement in this case, including by eliminating from our formulation entirely a buffer. All the asserted claims call for a specific type of buffer at a specific concentration.
So how does your formulation control the pH if you don't have a buffer?
So, Your Honor, unfortunately, because of the limited amount of time...
I'm just curious, because the FDA seemed to think that wasn't a problem.
So... Unfortunately, because of the limited amount of time we had at trial, our expert wasn't able to get into it in too much detail. But he does say at one point, and the district court did find this, that it was through judicious use of excipients that we were able to formulate an enalapril liquid that didn't fluctuate in pH too much. This is an active ingredient that is labile, acid labile. And through judicious use of excipients, we don't use sodium benzoate, for instance, which is very acidic, which would drop the pH.
I don't want to use up your time, but it just struck me as like wow, how did you get this job done?
And in retrospect, we probably should have filed a patent application on this. My client's a very small generic drug company, and we just wanted to bring a generic version to market. But that's essentially how we got around the buffer limitation here. We also used a preservative system, methylparaben and propylparaben, that is expressly described in the common specification as being used as being a suitable alternative to claimed sodium benzoate, but was never claimed, which provided us with a factual and legal defense. But most importantly, we relied on claim amendments and express disclaimers as already made during prosecution that narrow the literal and equivalent scope of these claims. We did all this in hopes of avoiding protracted patent litigation. Unfortunately, we ended up being subjected to, for the next 2.5 years, what we respectfully submit can only be described as objectively baseless litigation. The judgment of non-infringement should be affirmed. Starting with our legal defenses, which at least Judge Clevenger showed somewhat of an interest in, we believe amendment-based estoppel bars their claims here. It appears the fundamental dispute here is between the parties that, in Azurdi's position, somehow our product is outside of the scope of territory that was surrendered during prosecution. We respectfully submit that's an erroneous view that's based on an incredibly narrow view of amendment-based estoppel that's never been endorsed by this court or the Supreme Court. In Azurdi's view, we could only enjoy amendment-based estoppel if we followed the claims and just omitted sodium citrate or used less than the required amount. If we made any other changes to the formulation, then we're outside of amendment-based estoppel protection. And that just, common sense-wise, that doesn't make sense. It's a view that's never been endorsed by this court. We not only omitted sodium citrate, we don't use citric acid, and we don't use sodium benzoate. So we designed even further around the claims, we should still be able to enjoy amendment-based estoppel protection. Tangential relation, the reason why they added sodium citrate to the broader 603 application claims was to narrow the scope of the claims to cover the only liquids that they actually had unexpected results for. They were facing an obviousness rejection. The only way they could overcome obviousness was by pointing to unexpected results or relying on unexpected results. Unfortunately, the only liquids for which they had unexpected results were the example E liquids, which all require specific concentrations of citric acid, sodium citrate, and sodium benzoate. That was the reason they narrowed the scope of the claims. The alleged equivalent in our product, this alleged maleic acid sodium malate system, cannot be said to be tangential to that because they had no unexpected results for our formulation. Argument-based estoppel. The dispute really centers on the four-ingredient disclaimer they issued. In Azurity's view of argument-based estoppel, that can only be invoked if a patent applicant see something in the prior art, points to it and says, that's not us. They actually did that here during prosecution. It's the second sentence of the disclaimer. They say, these additional excipients in the other formulations are not needed or contemplated in the claimed inalapril liquid formulations as none of them are needed or necessary to produce an oral liquid formulation of the present claims that is stable. And this idea that a disclaimer is not a disclaimer if it's disguised as a motivation or reasonable success argument finds no support in this court's case law. Disclosure dedication. They take issue with the district court's failure to include the word specific in its articulation of the legal standard here. Last month, this court in Adapt Pharma versus Teva Pharmaceuticals, that's 2022 Westlaw 402133 at star 10, this court made clear that Rule 52A does not require a district court to find facts does not require the district court to articulate a legal standard that it's following, only to find the facts specifically and state the conclusions of law separately. Azurdi points to nothing in the district court's opinion or in the record showing that the district court departed from the requirement for specificity.
Can I just ask one quick question? On this alleged claim construction issue, it's your position that there was no claim construction that was made. Instead, that was just the district court's fact-finding on what the function was. Am I correct on that?
So I think it was I think their argument is more geared towards whether or not Azurity proved there was a buffer to begin with before we even get to the equivalent step. Because the district court found, first of all, that they failed to prove the existence of a buffer in our product. Forget about
that. And went on and said, assuming that's not correct, I'm going to talk about function wave result now and decide on that issue.
But their claim, that's correct, Judge Stoll, but their claim construction argument was more directed to the former, whether or not there was even a buffer to begin with, rather than the equivalency issue. Again, we respectfully submit they're just trying to secure de novo review on what would otherwise be a factual issue that's reviewed by clear error here. Both parties agreed that for Azurity to prove the existence of a buffer in our product, it needed to do two things. First of all, it needed to show there were appreciable quantities of weak acid and conjugate base in our product, not just a few free-floating species in our formulation. Appreciable quantities of weak acid and conjugate base. They admit that. That's a gray brief at 8. If appreciable quantities of both weak acid and conjugate base are present, the formulation contains a buffer. Second, the parties agreed that for Azurity to carry its burden of proving a buffer in our product, they needed to show that the strength of the weak acid, i.e. its pKa, must be within a certain range of the formulation pH. They disagreed about what that proper range was, but those were the two facts that they had to prove to show the existence of a buffer. Forget about whether or not it's equivalent or not. They failed on both points. With respect to appreciable quantities of weak acid and conjugate base in our product, the district court credited our expert's testimony, who said maleic acid may not be fully dissociating from enalapril, and the sodium hydroxide added to the penultimate step of our formulation process may be reacting with other acidic components in our product, including enalapril itself, the mixed berry, the parabens, and that there was just no evidence, and the district court made the specific finding that an appreciable buffer is formed. That's Appendix 41 to 42. So we respectfully submit this is a fact dispute. There's no error, let alone clear error here. The other thing informing the court's opinion on this is, and they really don't touch on this too much in their briefing, is the fact that their expert's credibility was undermined. And also that their expert was found less credible than our expert, who was a tried-and-true formulator, and who'd actually formulated oral solutions with the excipients we're dealing with here in this case. Even if they did prove there were appreciable quantities of maleic acid and sodium maleate in our product, they failed to prove that it was a buffer, because both sides agreed that for a weak acid and conjugate base to qualify as a buffer, it had to behave as a buffer, and the only way it could is if the pKa was within a certain range of the formulation pH. Our expert said plus or minus 1. Their expert said plus or minus 2. Our expert backed his opinion up with corroborating written documentation that corroborated his opinion. Their expert did not. Their expert was also found less qualified and his credibility undermined on this issue. So another classic fact dispute that went in our favor, that they failed to establish error, let alone clear error. Even if the district court erred on its finding that they failed to prove the presence of a buffer in our product, judgment of non-infringement should still be affirmed because they failed to prove that it was equivalent. On function way result, I think their biggest complaint is that the district court relied on the citizen petition to determine the proper function of the buffer. We respectfully submit the specific function of the claimed buffer limitation, which goes beyond just buffer. It's buffer and the concentration elements, which we submit are really important. The spec never actually spells out what that function is. It does spell out the function of buffering agents. We agree on the meaning of buffer, but it never actually spells out the function of the claimed buffer limitation itself, in this case, a citrate buffer at specific concentrations. Therefore, it was appropriate for the district court to rely on the citizen petition to find out which spoke exactly to the purpose of that claimed buffer, that citrate buffer. Even if that was error, that the function way result findings can still be upheld on appeal because we argued that the primary function of the buffer was to maintain formulation pH beyond any pH maintenance provided by any acid dissociated from enalapril. And we argued that because there is no written description here in the common specification of any enalapril liquid where the only buffer is acid dissociated from enalapril, let alone one that's stable for 12 months at refrigerated conditions.
What about dedication and disclosure?
So, thank you, Your Honor. On that, we respectfully submit that, again, the primary dispute between the parties is the level of specificity that's required here. And we respectfully submit we've met that level of specificity, that specification discloses that methylparaben and propylparaben are suitable preservatives.
What role does the 482 patent play in this analysis?
Thank you, Your Honor. So the 482 patent is a continuation. It claims priority to these patents, and therefore, presumably, all the claims in that 482 patent must be adequately described and enabled in these priority patents in the in the common specification. And the claims of the 482 patent actually claim in allopro liquids where the only required buffer is...
It reads on your product.
Correct. That's correct. And so under this court's case law, they can't erase that distinction by now arguing equivalence with respect to the earlier patents.
So even if there's a dedicated disclosure in this case, there is a continuation patent that has the express limitations that at least with respect to this particular patent are dedicated to the public for purposes of doctrine of equivalence.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. That is correct. Even though arguably, although we're not conceding that right now, but arguably maybe these later claims do read on our product if they're valid. That's correct.
But the 482 patent also teaches a little bit about what a POSA would have understood looking at the terrain, correct? I mean,
yeah, I think it's the same specification, so there's really no more teaching there. And that is that's an issue that we have with them in some...
Right, but I mean the notion that nobody would combine these two substances.
That's exactly...
The two substances are clearly dedicated and disclosed, the combination. So there was testimony from your expert that one of skill in the art would understand. The patent itself recognizes that you can have mixtures. And as I understood, your expert was to testify that, yeah, one of the skill in the art would understand you could take these two things and mix them.
They were the most commonly known.
And then the 482 is sort of the maraschino cherry on top of the ice cream sundae, right?
That's exactly right, Judge Clevenger.
Example C? I was asking your adversary about example C in particular.
So I think...
C2.
Thank you, Judge Stoll.
Do you agree with my reading of that?
I think his argument there is... he didn't articulate it here, but it's in his brief. His argument that we can't rely on C1 and C2, and I believe there's one other one that uses both methylparaben and propylparaben, it's A6. I believe his argument, at least in his briefing, I'm not sure what it is today, but in his brief it was, well, you can't rely on those because there's another preservative in there. Maybe not sodium benzoate. It's potassium sorbate, I believe it is. Essentially what Azurity's arguing here is you can only have disclosure dedication if you have a disclosed but unclaimed embodiment, as opposed to looking at it as a limitation by limitation exercise. That's something this court rejected in Johnson and Johnson versus RE Services. Basically, in Azurity's world, we could only enjoy disclosure dedication protection if the specification disclosed and an allopro liquid where the only preservatives were used were methylparaben and propylparaben alone. And that finds no support in this court's case law. Just one other thing I'd like to point out on equivalence, if this court even gets that far, on remedies. Their point that somehow this is unfair, it's a predicament of our own making. We tried to get out of this case early and via an early dispositive motion. We were denied in part because they argued we were so close to trial. Now we have a judgment that's based on multiple factual, legal and factual grounds. This court is not required to reach every single ground if it's going to affirm on our legal defenses. Had infringement, our legal defense had been resolved before trial, they wouldn't be in this predicament they're in right now. Thank you. Unless the court has any further questions.
Any more questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Thorsen, you have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's go directly back to the disclosure dedication doctrine. Your Honor had asked about the table. Another difference that wasn't pointed out is that those are both sodium salts, which is not what they're using. Again, the point is that you're not supposed to bring an obviousness-like analysis and say, could somebody figure this out? It's not even written description. So is there an embodiment that shows methyl and propylparaben not in salt form? No. And so the fact that we have generic claims because we have lots of species disclosed doesn't change the fact that that particular combination was not dedicated. I'd like to quickly go through, if I could, some of the other issues. On amendment-based estoppel, their version of this would limit us to a single species that was amended in another patent, even though that combination of limitations already existed in one claim. Whether or not that's limiting, the question is in this patent, is it limiting? And the answer has to be no. Just look at the claims. The claims here are much broader than that. Also, look at their four-ingredient argument. A disavowal has to be clear. And yet, the examiner told us that we should actually eliminate one of those ingredients because it wasn't necessary for patentability. There can't be any clear evidence that there's no disavowal, but there certainly isn't clear evidence that there was. On function way result, there's really no debate about the function. The function is that it's got to act as a buffer. But we didn't agree to this one unit away limitation on it. If they'd wanted that, they should have asked for it in claim construction. They didn't. Instead, what they tried to do is force it in with only on the basis of extrinsic evidence. There's nothing in the intrinsic evidence that requires that. Our expert showed why even two units out, this would be okay, and he did it with the math of the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, which is gold standard evidence in this area. And finally, the real question about whether the way is limited or whether we're trying to cover all buffers is the fact that the result's the same, right? At the end of the day, you have to have a buffer. Both sides have an acid-based buffer system, and you have to have a result that this is stable for 1 to 2 years at 5 degrees Celsius. There's no question that they've had that. So you have the same function, a buffer. You have it working in the same way. However you got there, because the ions are agnostic to how they were created, you have an acid-based system. And in that acid-based system, you get the result of long-term stability. Unless there are any questions.
Anything else for counsel?
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission. Thank you.